Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today we're opening up quite a stack of sources, actually, to explore a really remarkable figure. Complex, certainly, and yeah, often controversial, Gertrude Bell.
She's fascinating, isn't she? I mean, her life reads like something out of fiction, but the impact, well, the impact was very real, with lasting geopolitical consequences.
Exactly. Explorer, archaeologist, linguist, writer, mountaineer.
And, crucially, a central figure in shaping the modern Middle East, especially Iraq.
So our goal here is to unpack what the sources suggest is, you know, most important about her journey and her legacy.
Yeah, trying to get a handle on it. Think about the time she lived in, born into that Victorian world, but operating right through the fall of the Ottoman Empire, rise of British power.
She just defied expectations constantly.
Completely. So we'll try to trace how this, well, this privileged, incredibly independent woman went from climbing Alps and digging up ruins
to advising kings and quite literally drawing lines on maps, lines that still cause debate today.
It's a story about knowledge, definitely, but also about power and, as you said, a really contested legacy.
Okay, let's start at the beginning then. She was born in 1868 into the Bell family. And the sources really hammer this home, and they were incredibly wealthy. Among the, what, six wealthiest families in England?
Yeah, that's really key context, actually. Industrialists. Her grandfather, Sir Isaac Lothian Bell, big name in industry, science, even an MP.
And her father, Sir Thomas Hugh Bell, kept the fortune going, but was also, well, quite progressive for the time, wasn't he? Supported education, encouraged Gertrude's interests, even in things like politics.
Which was unusual. And her mother died when she was very young, leading to this really close bond with her father, apparently. Her stepmother, Lady Florence Bell, was also important, very cultured, intellectual, encouraged those pursuits, too.
So that whole environment, the money, the connections, but also that that liberal support for her doing things differently.
It gave her freedom, opportunities that just weren't available to most women then. It let her carve out her own path, you know.
And what a path. I mean, her education alone, Oxford, Lady Margaret Hall.
And not just Oxford, but she achieved first-class honors in modern history. First woman ever.
In 1888, she was only 20 and did it in just 2 years.
It's phenomenal. But here's a telling detail the sources point out. Because she was a woman, her degree was technically honorary at first.
Right. Women couldn't officially graduate until 1920.
Imagine that. Getting top marks, but not the full piece of paper. You have to wonder if that kind of thing just, well, fueled her ambition to prove herself in other fields. Fields dominated by men.
Which she certainly did. She wasn't just sitting in libraries. She was a serious adventurer. Mountaineering, especially in the Alps, was a huge part of her life for several years.
Around 1899 and 1904, yeah. And the sources describe her as pretty fearless. Got first ascents on several peaks. One's even named after her, Gertrude Spitz.
And that survival story, the 53-hour blizzard on the Finsterhorn in 1902, just incredible grit.
Absolutely. She climbed the big ones, Mont Blanc, the Matterhorn. These weren't gentle hikes.
And mountains weren't enough. She traveled constantly, 2 round-the-world trips with her half-brother, India, China, Japan.
But the real turning point, according to the sources, was that first trip to Persia, modern Iran, back in 1892.
That's what lit the fire, wasn't it? Her lifelong fascination with the Middle East.
Exactly. It led to her first book, Safarnameh. And you can really see how the skills she was developing, planning climbs, assessing risk, leadership, just sheer resilience.
Were perfect training for what came next. Exploring deserts, dealing with tribal politics. It's a direct line.
The sources also, they sort of hint that maybe some of this drive towards these really demanding, independent things might have been pushed along by, well, the limits society placed on women, or perhaps even some personal disappointments in her life.
Romantic disappointments, yeah. Like Henry Cadogan, Charles Doughty Wiley. It's part of her story.
But what really stands out when she turns to the Middle East is how she combined that drive with an incredible gift for languages.
Oh, absolutely key. Her linguistic ability was, well, kind of her superpower in the region. Fluent Arabic, Persian, French, German, Italian, Turkish too. Some sources even say possibly Hebrew.
She apparently mastered classical Persian in just 2 years after that first trip. Amazing. And then she dedicated herself to learning Arabic in Jerusalem around 1899, 1900.
Some accounts say she became even more proficient than T.E. Lawrence.
Which is saying something. And it wasn't just about being able to order food, you know. This let her dive deep, understand local politics, talk directly to tribal leaders, build relationships, no intermediaries needed.
Which, down the line, made her an incredibly valuable intelligence asset.
Precisely. And this deep immersion, It led her towards archaeology around 1904. She wasn't just dabbling. She got formal training with Salomon Reinach.
So she starts leading these expeditions, right? Across modern Turkey, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, a huge area.
Yeah, between roughly 1905 and 1914. And her work documenting specific sites, like Ukadir in Iraq, is seen as really significant. She visited it a few times.
Her book on Ukadir, The Palace and Mosque Ukadir, the sources highlight this as a major piece of scholarship. The first really detailed Western study of that kind of early Islamic architecture there.
She also worked at Bin Berkeley's in Turkey, the 1001 churches, excavated there with Sir William Ramsay. Noted how much was being lost even then, people taking stones for building.
She was at Babylon too, wasn't she, watching the big German digs?
Yes. Visited several times. Was apparently very impressed with their methods. Later during the war, she actually advised Sir Percy Cox on how to preserve sites like Babylon and stop illicit digging.
In Kirkemish, that Hittite city on the Syria-Turkey border now, sources mention she mapped ruins there.
And that's where she first met T.E. Lawrence.
Right. And the sources also note Carchemish was a bit of a spying hub back then. Shows how blurred the lines were becoming.
Absolutely. Archaeology, exploration, intelligence gathering, it was all getting mixed up. What's undeniable is the value of her documentation, her photographs, her detailed notes. They are incredible historical records now, especially for sites that have been damaged or destroyed since.
She got recognition for it, too. Fellow of the Royal Geographical Society in 1913, the Founders Medal later on.
Definitely acknowledged as a serious explorer and documenter. But again, context is everything. Her work was made easier because she was British, operating during a time of growing British influence.
And all that knowledge she was gathering, the languages, the geography, who's who in the tribes, it wasn't just academic anymore, was it?
No. It was becoming incredibly valuable information for British strategic interests. The scholar was, perhaps unintentionally at first, becoming an intelligence asset. That line. It was getting very blurry indeed.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Raj Bosch Hannah.
Ah, perfect timing. Just what we needed.
How's the chai looking today? What's the verdict?
Let's see. Ooh, that's got a good color. Yeah. It's good today. Nicely balanced, I think. Not too bitter.
Excellent. Okay, lovely. Right then. So, nicely refreshed. Where were we? Ah, yes, the shift. How all that incredible knowledge she'd gathered through travel and archaeology turned into something very different during the war.
Yes, wartime intelligence. As World War I got going, the British desperately needed people who actually understood the Arabian Peninsula.
And Bell's knowledge was pretty much unparalleled, wasn't it? The landscape, the tribes, the languages, what the sources call her grasp of the human terrain.
Exactly. It made her indispensable. So British military intelligence recruited her in late 1915.
She ended up in the Arab Bureau in Cairo, working alongside people like T.E. Lawrence and D.G. Hogarth.
And her role was vital. Processing intelligence coming in, making maps, writing detailed reports for the Arab Bulletin that was the Bureau's intelligence summary. She was assessing tribal loyalties, advising on strategy.
Basically helping figure out how to undermine the Ottomans and encourage the Arab revolt.
And she was unique in this role. The sources stress this. She was the first woman officer in British military intelligence. Effectively held the rank of Major Miss Bell, they sometimes called her. Later, the only female political officer.
Then she moved to Basra in 1916, working directly under Sir Percy Cox. That seems like a really key move.
Huge. Because Cox becomes a major figure in post-war Iraq. Her work in Basra cemented her reputation as someone with essential on-the-ground knowledge.
So this wartime intelligence work, while obviously focused on the conflict,
it was absolutely laying the foundation for Britain's post-war plans. Shaping their understanding, identifying potential allies, figuring out how they could exert influence once the Ottomans were gone.
Which brings us squarely to her most famous and definitely most controversial period, the making of modern Iraq.
Yes. In 1917, she's appointed Oriental Secretary in Baghdad, again under Sir Percy Cox. This wasn't just an informal role, it was a proper salaried position. The sole female political officer in the entire British administration in Mesopotamia, as it was called then.
And her duties were immense, weren't they?
Absolutely critical. She was the main liaison with Arab leaders, constantly briefing the British administration on local affairs, tribal dynamics, drafting major policy reports.
Like the Arab of Mesopotamia and that really important 1920 white paper, the Review of the Civil Administration of Mesopotamia. That one actually recommended how Britain should run the place.
And one very concrete, very symbolic role she played was actually helping draw Iraq's borders.
There's that quote from her letter, isn't there? December 1921, something like, spent the morning productively fixing the southern desert borders of Iraq. Just casually dropping it in.
It sounds casual, but the context was anything but. This is happening after the Sykes-Picot Agreement had already, you know, theoretically carved up the region between Britain and France. Bill was involved in the messy business of making those lines, or adjusted versions of them, real on the ground.
And this is where a lot of the criticism comes in, which the sources highlight quite strongly.
Yes. The argument is that these borders were often drawn based on British imperial priorities, oil pipelines, strategic access, rather than, say, existing ethnic or tribal realities, or even geographical logic sometimes.
The inclusion of the Mosul region in Iraq is a key example cited. Bell argued strongly for it, based on economic and population reasons from her perspective.
But the consequence, critics point out, was lumping a large Kurdish population into the new Arab-dominated state, dividing them from Kurds in Turkey and Syria, and contributing to their statelessness. It was a decision with huge long-term repercussions.
Then there was the 1920 Iraqi Revolt, a massive uprising against British rule.
A reaction against direct administration, taxes, the whole mandate system being imposed.
Mm-hmm.
Bell was right in the middle of it, analyzing it, reporting on it for the British. It's covered in that 1920 review paper.
And that revolt really spooked the British, didn't it?
It did. It showed them that trying to rule Iraq directly was going to be bloody and expensive. It pushed them firmly towards a policy of indirect control, finding a local ruler they could work with or, well, manage.
Which leads directly to the Cairo Conference in 1921.
Absolute pivotal moment. Winston Churchill, who was colonial secretary then, called this summit to sort out the future of the British-controlled Middle East and, crucially, to cut the costs of administering it.
And Gertrude Bell was there, the only woman delegate.
Her influence there, the sources suggest, was immense. She, along with Cox and Lawrence, were the main voices pushing for what's called the Sharifian solution.
Which meant putting Emir Faisal, son of Sharif Hussein of Mecca, on the throne of this new country, Iraq.
Exactly. Bell was apparently instrumental in convincing Churchill that Faisal was the right man for the job, and also in confirming that Mosul would be part of Iraq, despite other ideas floating around, like maybe a separate Kurdish buffer state.
So she becomes the key architect of Faisal becoming King Faisal of Iraq in August 1921.
She really did. And she became his close advisor, his confidant. He relied on her heavily. Iraqis apparently called her Al-Kakun, the lady of the court. She helped him set up his government, navigate the incredibly complex politics, try to win over all the different groups, Sunni, Shia, Kurds, other minorities. She mediated between Faisal and the British, too.
But again, the sources stress the complexity here. This nation-building exercise was happening under a British mandate. It wasn't independent.
No, and that's the core tension in her legacy, isn't it? Sources talk about her genuine affection for Iraq, her desire to see it stable and functioning, but ultimately she was serving British imperial interests, securing oil, maintaining a strategic foothold in the region.
And the decisions made reflected that Faisal wasn't Iraqi. He was brought in largely because the British thought he'd be pliable and could unify the country under their supervision.
The sources also bring up criticisms regarding her own potential biases. Some argue she favored the Sunni Arab elite, like Faisal, and was perhaps dismissive or suspicious of the Shia religious leadership, and viewed the Kurds as inherently difficult, maybe ungovernable.
And the argument follows that these attitudes, embedded in the structures she helped create, contributed to power imbalances right from the start, sowing seeds for future sectarian conflict and instability.
It's a heavy charge. And it wasn't just later historians saying this. Even contemporaries like Lawrence sometimes had critiques. The sources mentioned Bell herself had moments of doubt about whether the whole structure would actually hold together long term.
So her political legacy, it's just incredibly contested. Was she a modernizing force helping Iraq find its feet? Or primarily an agent of empire whose actions had damaging consequences?
The sources really presented as both, intertwined. You can't separate the two sides of her role.
And her ability to operate at this level, it obviously depended on her relationships with the powerful figures of the day.
Absolutely. We've mentioned T.E. Lawrence. They met at Carchemish, worked together in the Arab Bureau, were both at Cairo. Shared goals sometimes, but also differences, particularly over Mosul, apparently.
Yeah.
Lawrence could be quite critical of the outcomes.
Her sway with Winston Churchill at Cairo was clearly vital. Persuading him on Faisal and Mosul, that's high-level influence.
And Sir Percy Cox was her long-term mentor and superior. He clearly valued her expertise immensely, relying on her as his Oriental secretary. they collaborated closely on that indirect rule strategy.
And then the relationship with King Faisal himself. She championed him, advised him, believed he could unite Iraq al-Khatun.
She also interacted with other key Arab leaders like Ibn Saud, navigated those complex desert politics, and she clashed with other British officials like Sir Arnold Wilson, who favored a much more direct form of British rule.
The sources briefly mention figures like St. John Philby too, another intelligence operative, and her earlier romantic interests, Cadogan and Doughty Wiley. They're part of her personal narrative, highlighting her independence perhaps in the face of an unfulfilled personal life.
But really, it's those professional relationships built on her knowledge and personality that were central to her political impact.
Alongside her actions, we have to talk about her writing. She was incredibly prolific. It's a huge part of how we understand her and the period.
Definitely. Her travelogues, like Syria, the desert, and the Sone, or Amaroth to Amaroth, through these amazing snapshots of the region before World War I changed everything.
Then her archaeological publications, like the ones on Bin Berkeley's and Uqadir, serious scholarly work.
She even translated poetry poems from Hafiz. Shows her linguistic depth again.
And those official reports we mentioned, the Arab of Mesopotamia, the 1920 Review White Paper, these weren't just observations, they were policy documents shaping British actions. That white paper might have been the first one authored by a woman.
And perhaps most importantly for researchers today, there's her massive personal correspondence.
Yeah.
Thousands and thousands of letters, plus her diaries.
Published after her death, mostly. They give this incredibly intimate, detailed view of her experiences, her thoughts, the events unfolding around her.
It's all collected in the Gertrude Bell Archive at Newcastle University. An amazing resource. 16,000 letters, diaries, notebooks, around 7,000 photographs, maps.
It's recognized by UNESCO, isn't it? Memory of the World Register.
Yes, for its global significance. It's largely digitized now, too, so accessible. But the sources do add a note of caution. Because we have so much from her own perspective, her story is inevitably filtered through her voice, her biases. Critical reading is essential.
Okay, so let's try and pull it all together. Her legacy. The sources paint this picture of, well, multiple legacies, really. Contributions alongside deep controversies.
On the positive side, her impact on preserving Iraq's cultural heritage is undeniable and widely praised. Founding the Iraq Museum, originally the Baghdad Museum, was her passion project.
She fought hard for antiquities to remain in Iraq, didn't she? The sources say she defended like a tigress the principle that finds should stay in their country of origin. That was radical then.
Absolutely. She drafted Iraq's first antiquities law in 1924 based on that principle. She even left money in her will for a British school of archaeology in Iraq. This work is seen as vital for fostering Iraqi national identity, connecting the modern nation to its incredibly rich ancient past.
But then there's the other side, the political side. And the sources are very clear. Many ongoing problems in Iraq, things like sectarian divisions, border issues, they get traced back by critics to the decisions made during the British mandate.
Decisions in which she was a key player. The criticisms about the borders drawn for British interests, ignoring local realities, the Mosul question, and Kurdish statelessness keep coming up.
And the installation of Faisal, seen by many as imposing a foreign monarch, essentially an instrument of colonial control, leading to a monarchy that proved fragile in the long run.
And again, that point about potentially favoring Sunni leadership, dismissing Shia and Kurdish concerns, contributing to power imbalances that some argue fueled conflict later on. Contemporary critiques existed, and her legacy on this front remains deeply contested.
The sources also discuss how she's viewed through post-colonial and Orientalist lenses.
Yes, analyzed in the tradition of Edward Said. Critics argue that, despite her genuine knowledge and affection, her work ultimately served Western imperialism. Her writing sometimes reinforced Orientalist tropes, exoticism, timelessness, maybe perceived inferiority of local societies compared to the West.
Essentializing groups, perhaps favoring the authentic Bedouin over urban populations?
Right. Even with good intentions, her work was framed within that colonial power structure. She embodies a kind of hybridity, as some scholars put it, advocating for some Iraqi self-determination, but always as an agent of the British Empire. Which is why, the sources note, her perception within Iraq itself can be complex, sometimes seen as a spy or figure tied to the occupation.
Her role in the aftermath of Sykes-Picot is also emphasized. Not part of the original secret deal.
But absolutely central in implementing and modifying it on the ground in Iraq. Shaping its territory, especially with Mosul, making Iraq a cornerstone of Britain's post-war Middle East system.
she really becomes the embodiment of that expert colonial administrator, leveraging deep regional knowledge for the benefit of the empire.
Her career is just a powerful case study, isn't it? Showing the interplay between individual agency, specialized knowledge, and the overwhelming forces of colonial power and geopolitics. The consequences ripple down through generations.
So Gertrude Bell, undeniably an extraordinary figure, someone who broke molds, challenged expectations, and had this profound, lasting impact on the Middle East.
Yeah, and her legacy really has those two distinct sides. The tangible contributions to archaeology, the founding of the Iraq Museum, set against the hugely controversial political role in the creation of modern Iraq, with all the debate that still surrounds it.
She really defies any simple classification, doesn't she? Her story is still being unpacked, still being argued over.
Absolutely. Which maybe leaves us, and you listening, with a final thought to chew on, something the sources implicitly raise. How much can the actions of even well-intentioned individuals, people with genuine local knowledge and affection, become entangled with and ultimately defined by the larger machinery of empire? And in reshaping nations according to external interests, is future instability almost an inevitable byproduct?
That's a heavy question to end on. If you do want to delve deeper into her own words and images, the Gertrude Bell Archive at Newcastle University is, as the sources mention, the place to go. Thank you for joining us for this exploration today.